Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all our listeners. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Mdiwa Gavaza, and for today, we are talking about why in some cases it's better to, you know, to be a generalist or to at least diversify your line of business. And to help us to talk about these issues, we are joined by Dorf Gurnan, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Merchant Capital. He recently, you know, penned a piece called The Rise of the Generalist, and we're just going to be talking to him about, you know, the piece, but also how Merchant Capital is using some of these philosophies in their own business. Dorf, greetings to you.
Mdiwa, how are you? Great to be on your show and thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for taking your time to be with us. A good place for us to start, for those that may not know, Merchant Capital, who are you guys and what is it that you guys do?
So we are an alternative credit provider. We provide working capital loans to small businesses across South Africa. We've been going now for about 7 or close on 8 years. And really the founding principle of Merchant Capital was to provide easy, simple working capital to small businesses who are looking to grow their business. So the business was founded by myself and my partners who are and have been serial entrepreneurs. And really out of experience of our own journey as entrepreneurs, we realized how difficult it was to raise finance and working capital, specifically in the early days of when in one's business cycle, when one is trying to build a business. And it was really out of that need and personal experience that we wanted to create a product that could alleviate some of that pain that entrepreneurs and small business owners face when trying to grow their business. So we have been laser focused on providing a core product to our customers. We've probably helped now close on 10,000 small businesses with working capital. We've deployed close on 2 billion rand in the past 7 years, and it feels like the journey is just really getting started. As this kind of SME and entrepreneurship becomes more relevant in South Africa as we need to come out of this COVID pandemic.
Now, we've actually had, I won't say a number, but we've also engaged with, I don't know whether you consider them to be competitors, but other firms such as Retail Capital and Lulaland, for example. And it does sound as if this is, I'll call it a burgeoning space. You know, this alternative lending space. And I'd be keen to get your thoughts just around why do you think there has been room for companies like yours to actually, you know, get a foothold and grow? Why is it that traditional lenders have decided to maybe not attend to this market?
I think it's a great discussion point and clearly something that I'm passionate about. Retail Capital and Lululend are, you know, competitors of ours, but I view them more as colleagues and friends. The market is so large, it's so fragmented, and frankly, there's space for quite a few players to try and plug this gap. So although we will deem ourselves competitors in the market, we are close and we try and collaborate on lots of fronts because we all have one common goal, and that common goal is trying to build the SME sector in South Africa. So pleased that you've chatted to my colleagues. And yeah, I wish there was more of them because there really is a big need. I think the reason, you know, mostly, and by the way, this is not purely a South African problem. You know, so globally, what you're seeing, specifically after the global financial crisis of 2008 and 2009, because of the new rules and parameters such as Basel, et cetera, that had to be put into the banking institutions to try and salvage them out of the financial crisis, they pulled back on lending to, call it, riskier, smaller businesses. And as I say, that has been a trend in kind of first world countries such as the US and Europe and Australia, and more so in emerging markets where kind of the SMEs are deemed to be even riskier because they, you know, there's not a huge amount of data or collateral that these business owners can provide. So I think it was a sense of the banks trying to focus on what they do well, you know, and that could be much bigger loans to big corporates, it could be overdrafts, credit cards, consumer banking, etc. And that really created this call it this funding gap specifically that we've seen in South Africa. And you know, being an emerging market such as South Africa, where entrepreneurship is such an important milestone, or is a cornerstone, I should say, of alleviating some of the unemployment and other issues that we have, the need for alternative lenders to come in and try and support and augment these guys, their business growth, has never been more important and continues to be extremely important as you know, as kind of this opportunity or this market and industry grows.
And I guess with that, could you then give us some, maybe some insights into why you think that being a generalist then is a better way of operating? What has COVID-19 actually taught you that has aged you to reach this position philosophically?
So you alluded to the article that I wrote, I think about a month ago, and the response to that article, I have to say, has been quite overwhelming. So clearly it was a decision point or a thought process that a lot of people in South Africa and globally, you know, were kind of attuned to and thinking about. And really what I said in the article in summary is that I personally have grown up with the idea that in order to be successful at something, you need to be a specialist. You know, so Malcolm Gladwell, who is a famous author in the US, who has written lots of books that people, you know, have enjoyed and have been bestsellers, wrote about a philosophy about 10,000 hours. And what he said in this book was that in order to be successful, you need to spend at least 10,000 hours. Now, if you work that out, that is a lot of time. And in order to be really good or the top of your field, you need to be a specialist and really focus. And that kind of message or thought process was something that I've always been led to believe, and there was no reason not to believe it. I then picked up a book on a recommendation, which is authored by a guy by the name of David Epstein, who used to be a Sports Illustrated sports journalist, and has recently kind of moved into more of a business and kind of psychology. And the book just gripped me. And the reason why it gripped me is, so first of all, I'm a big sports fan. I'm a huge sports fanatic and have always grown up in a very sporty environment. And what he does in the beginning of the book is he compares two of probably the most famous sportsmen, certainly in my generation. The first one being Tiger Woods. So Tiger Woods, for those of your listeners that don't know, you know, he was from a very early age, from the age of two, his father kind of drummed into him that golf was his life and that's all that he specialized in. So he was swinging a club at two. He won his first tournament at the age of seven, and kind of went on to win a record amount of PGA tournaments. And he is the perfect example of the specialist because it's 10,000 hours plus. He then compares it to, you know, probably one of the greatest tennis players of our time, a guy by the name of Roger Federer. Now, Roger Federer, whose mother was South African, by the way, but he grew up in Switzerland. And when he grew up, his parents were very keen to push him not to specialize in one sport. So he was clearly a naturally sporty kid. And he did things such as basketball and tennis and football and skiing and wrestling. And interestingly enough, his mother was a tennis teacher. And it says in the book that she try to persuade him not to focus just on tennis. So the author refers to it as a pull parent as opposed to a push parent. So a push parent would be, you know, someone who really pushes their kids and puts a lot of pressure on them, and they were deemed to be pull parents. So they encouraged Roger Federer to broaden his sporting, you know, and just really have fun. And it was only really in his mid to late teens that he started focusing on tennis and obviously went on to be, you know, one of the greatest tennis players of all time. But his competitors, by the time he was 17 or 18, had Tiger Woods-like type of training and specialization. You know, so they were probably at tennis academies, you know, from the age of 6 or 7, and really had spent time trying to specialize and focus just on tennis. Where Roger Federer came into the tennis circuit or the professional tennis circuit with a much broader and more diversified type of background when it came to the sport. So I thought the analogy was extremely interesting because, you know, Tiger and Roger Federer would be my heroes because I'm a big golfer and I played a lot of tennis as a youngster. I just found it really interesting. And David Epstein, the author of the book, goes on to talk about a lot of other examples as to where successful people have actually been more of a generalist than a specialist in their upbringing. And from a work or from a career point of view, what's interesting is they did a study in Scotland at two of the top universities. And essentially, one group of the university students kind of specialized and really honed into a specific skill. And maybe that was engineering or mechanical engineering. I can't remember exactly. And the other group of students did more of a generalized degree. So they did philosophy and history and economics and maths, etc. Now, when they plotted those students over time into their careers, the specialist group got jobs quicker than the generalists and were paid higher initially. So maybe for the first, you know, 3 to 5 years, they got more specialized jobs with a higher paying salary. But what happened over the tenure of their career was that the generalists landed up earning more over, you know, 10, 15, or 20 years and actually did not burn out and were able to persist and be more resilient in their career than the specialists, because the specialists ultimately kind of hit a ceiling because they only kind of knew one thing and they either burnt out or kind of plateaued from an earnings point of view. So he kind of relates it back to sports, but you know, then puts it practically into medicine, business, politics, etc. And I just found the whole concept to be very novel because I think the majority of us have always been taught that in order to be successful, you need to specialize. And the data is empirical data that has now been demonstrated in this book and other studies that actually shows that ultimately the most successful, whether they are politicians, entrepreneurs, business people, or sports people, are the ones that actually have more of a diversified and generalist upbringing as opposed to the specialized.
So then, with all of that said and done, because as someone I've actually gone through outliers myself, and it is a pretty good deconstruction of our common notions of what success is and how it actually comes about. And you know, for us to then be challenging the specialization, I guess philosophy, it does sound as if there's a good argument to be made there. I guess the question now is, as you know, Merchant Capital, how are you guys, or how are you know, as a CEO, actually implementing this, if at all, this issue of specialization and being a generalist?
Yes, yeah, so I guess you know what we've done is because of this unpredicted or unprecedented pandemic that we've had over the last 6 months at Merchant Capital, sorry, or in South Africa that has affected Merchant Capital. We traditionally have been laser focused on supplying working capital to retail SMEs. So those are typically consumer-facing businesses that accept a point of sale. So your restaurant, your hairdresser, your fuel station, your hardware store. Now, what invariably happened was because of the pandemic, which obviously none of us could go and predict, a lot of the majority of our portfolio of our existing customers were affected or decimated by the pandemic. You know, so a restaurant owner is a perfect example. You know, so for the first 3 months they weren't allowed to trade, then they could only do takeaways without alcohol, and then alcohol was brought back and banned, etc. Now, you know, who in their wildest dreams as a restaurant owner would have thought that something would sweep across the country that wouldn't allow them to trade in some shape or form for 3 or 4 months? It was completely unprecedented. So what we had to do as a business, or we had to take a more generalist view of how we can provide support and product to SMEs. So we had to kind of get ourselves out of this self-imposed box that we had put ourselves in for the last, you know, 6 or 7 years, where it's been laser focused on a certain type of SME. And we needed to start thinking broader. We need to just start diversifying our thinking, new ways about product development and how we can support different type of SMEs as opposed to the ones that we've been supporting for the last 7 years. So as a perfect example, we kind of started thinking about how do we support the medical space? You know, so your GPs and doctors and specialists have been affected by COVID-19 because, you know, people aren't getting flu because they're staying at home and they're washing their hands and they are wearing masks. So that means they're not going to the GP. You know, if somebody had a routine elective surgery, such as a knee replacement or having orthodontists done on their on their teeth, everybody chose to delay that because everybody was scared and anxious about going into these medical facilities and catching COVID. So what happened was the turnover of these business owners or these health specialists dropped significantly. So we have now created a product which will be in the market shortly, which is a funding product tailor-made specifically for medical professionals. So that is, you know, that is one perfect example of something that pre-COVID we had never considered because we didn't have to and there wasn't a need for it. But now, you know, we've had to adapt and kind of pivot our thinking and our strategy in a from a product development point of view and create products that can help support SMEs and small business owners that actually need it most.
Perhaps we can, before we continue, maybe we should zoom out for a moment to maybe understand, just given your vantage point, to understand what does the funding gap actually look like? Or what did it look like before the pandemic actually, you know, took hold in March, at least in the local context? What did the funding gap look like when it comes to these to small businesses? And how do you think that has then been affected by COVID-19?
I mean, I think it's safe to say that the funding gap has only increased because more and more businesses who may have not needed funding pre-COVID, because of the things that I've just mentioned, for example, as a GP, never in his wildest dreams would have he thought he wouldn't have any patients coming into his practice for 3 months or 4 months or whatever it is. Same as a specialist, a surgeon, a dentist, etc. So I think you know, the kind of numbers I'm going to provide you with have only increased. I don't have intelligence as to what exactly that data is, but what I can safely say is that it's only gotten worse, or the funding gap has only increased. So I'll share some data that kind of we have, which is slightly outdated, but it still tells the story. So if you think about it, and if you look at the statistics of South Africa, there's about 1 million formally registered SMEs. And in a recent study that was done, when I say recent, probably about a year or a year and a half old, about 60%, so 600,000 of those million did not have access to typical bank finance, as an example. So that's kind of 600,000. We kind of look at a average loan size of about 100,000 rand, you know, and depending on the size of the SME. So if you do the math, that's a 60 billion rand funding gap just in the formally registered SMEs. Now, there could be, there is a whole lot of other SMEs who aren't formally registered. So that 60 billion is probably 80 or 90 billion. And I would hazard a guess to say that that gap has now increased to over 100 billion. So the numbers are staggering. And what is really profound about those numbers, or I guess quite sobering about the numbers, is the fact that without those businesses getting access to working capital and funding to grow their business, it's going to be very difficult for us as a country to try and tackle the systemic problems that we've got. So SMEs create economic activity. Economic activity helps with unemployment and job creation and the ability for people to get educated and pay for health services, etc. So there really is a kind of a burning platform when it comes to what this funding gap looks like. As you will know, the big banks, the big six, together with National Treasury and Reserve Bank, put together this COVID relief funding scheme of, I think it was 200 billion rand. I don't have the numbers offhand, but I believe in the beginning it was the take up was relatively slow, and I've heard some positive signs that The banks are doing better at now kind of deploying that money into the market, but still, I don't think it's getting to enough of the small business owners who are the guys that actually need it desperately. So suffice to say, the gap is increasing, and there's an urgent requirement to fill that gap. And as I said in the beginning, the likes of Merchant Capital and Retail Capital and Lulaland, unfortunately, we are only fulfilling a tiny portion of the business owners that need it. And we are hoping and optimistic that the bank's COVID relief fund will plug some of that gap, and other traditional financial services where these guys could access working capital and growth capital will hopefully go a long way to try and plugging that gap.
Coming back to the generalist conversation we're having just now, and considering the funding gap as well, that you've articulated to us the 60, pre-COVID, as an estimate, and then maybe that's now perhaps grown to over the 100 billion that you've mentioned just now. Would you not say that there's some credence in the generalist theory, in the sense that a lot of businesses have been forced either fundamentally pivot their businesses or to expand their product offerings during this time? Alcohol manufacturers that weren't able to maybe sell their wares in the local market, shifting over to sanitizer production, for example. Do you think there's any credence in businesses, taking that more generalist approach, so that over time they can, perhaps help their own prospects? Because businesses such as yours are sort of tied to the fortune of this SME sector.
Absolutely. I think that point is extremely well noted and valid. And, we have personally seen some inspiring stories from entrepreneurs in South Africa, and they continue to inspire me personally every day, because they have kind of had to get out of their comfort zone and really think out the box and essentially become a generalist in their thinking, because their specialist skill simply wasn't a viable business anymore, and that maybe was, for example, booking international holidays or travel, etc. So yes, you've definitely seen the cream rise to the top. There's a perfect example of a small restaurant, which kind of a neighborhood restaurant, just a couple of minutes from where we live in Joburg. And this restaurant was shut during the level five lockdown and the subsequent lockdowns. And what this restaurant owner did was he created a deli or a grocery store. He got some kind of essential supplies, so he was allowed to trade. And he then got suppliers from all over to come and put their product on the shelves. And he created an atmosphere and a vibe and an energy at this grocery store where people, obviously social distancing and wearing masks, but they would sit outside and have coffee and, buy their essential services, etc. So that is a perfect example of someone who, was dealt a blow and just pivoted or thought more broadly and more generally to how he can use what he's got. Your alcohol manufacturers is a perfect example. And really that business has thrived, and I can tell you it's created a huge amount of loyalty and credibility. And I can only assume, well, now that restaurant is kind of back, he still has the grocery store there. He also created something called a dark kitchen for Uber Eats and Mr. Delivery delivery services, where the food was manufactured in a kitchen, and just you have these delivery bikes kind of lining up to sell them. So that is just an anecdotal example of someone that is close to me, who managed to kind of not just take what he was dealt lying down and created an opportunity out of the chaos. And there's lots of stories like that from entrepreneurs here in South Africa.
I think as we end off the discussion, Dov, I'm very interested then to get your thoughts around what the prospects of the SME sector will be going forward. Do you anticipate that there are going to be more businesses that companies like yours can actually be lending to? Or do you think that because of the friction or the tension that COVID-19 has caused for SMEs, that you're going to have an even greater aversion to people trying to start their own businesses? Or do you see a situation where a number of people that were laid off because of COVID-19 have been sort of driven to start their own businesses, thereby growing the sector?
Yeah, so I'm going to have to go with the latter. And, you know, I am an eternal optimist and a huge supporter and believer of entrepreneurship in South Africa. So I think that, you know, when the dust settles, and it will, there will be lots of new opportunities which will be created by innovators, by dreamers, by thinkers, and by entrepreneurs. And, you know, it could be out of they have no choice. So there may have been huge scale retrenchments in corporates, and those guys now are left with, you know, they don't have the security blanket of a corporate paying job. So they need to now create an entrepreneurial or a side hustle or a new venture. Secondly, I also think that there will be a, you know, everybody's talking kind of about this new world or this post-COVID world. And within that, therein lies opportunities, because there will be new sectors of product and market and industry, which have now been opened, you know, to business owners that typically they wouldn't have had pre-COVID. So e-commerce is a perfect example. You know, e-commerce was such a small part of our economy. You know, it was less than, I think, 1 or 2% of total retail turnover. And that has been supercharged by the fact that businesses had to go online, and COVID was the catalyst. And, you know, I think there will be lots of opportunities and lots of derivatives or byproducts, I should say, of this kind of e-commerce boom in South Africa. And the guys that do have first mover advantage, etc., will be hugely successful. But there will be other opportunities. And lastly, what I want to say is that one thing that inspires me about entrepreneurs is that the way in South Africa, the way they think about their ventures is the fact that there is no plan B. So they almost don't have a choice as to whether they can make this work. And we see that every single day at Merchant Capital. And we, you know, our tagline is serving ambitious growth. And that's exactly what we try and do. We try and find business owners that have hugely ambitious growth plans and prospects and strategies. And we try to serve that through working capital and other financial services products. So I think you'll see a sense of resilience. You'll see a sense of persistence. You'll see a sense of just making it work, because there isn't really a plan B like you would potentially have in other markets such as the US or Europe, you know, where there's big government bailouts.
As a follow-up to what you've just said now, because you have taken the position that there are likely to be more SMEs when the dust actually settles. So for your own space as an alternative lender and the industry itself, how do you see the industry actually then evolving going forward? And especially considering, you know, what you've just said, because if a lot of people that had corporate jobs or any other type of employment have started their own businesses, does that mean they're going to be turning to their own, you know, their traditional banks for funding? Or do you see people turning more towards alternative lenders for them to be able to grow their own ventures? Because we've identified the funding gap that, you know, is likely existing at this moment. So how do you see that translating to your own industry?
I think there definitely will be an uptick in the requirement for alternative ways of doing things, and that will be alternative ways of receiving credit, alternative ways of onboarding insurance, alternative ways of doing HR, etc. Having said that, I do believe, and I fundamentally believe, that the banks play a huge role in this space. And we often say that our funding is not a replacement of typical bank funding. It's a collaboration, or it's an augmentation of that funding. So very often a bank will approve a business owner caller for R1 million who needs to do a refurbishment, but he needs 1.3. So he'll go to his bank for R1 million and he may get the balance of 300,000 from a business such as Merchant Capital or Lululand or Retail Capital. We are also very privileged and fortunate to have a strategic relationship with Standard Bank. And, you know, we work very closely with Standard Bank in trying to give their clients the best possible product offering and user experience. So I think it's going to be a combined effort. I think there's going to be an increase in demand for both products. And the big financial institutions have a huge role to play in trying to get the money into the hands of the business owners. And hopefully us as alternative lenders can do our small part to be able to augment or fill the gaps from what the big banks are going to hopefully be doing.
So that's been us. We're with Dorf Durnham, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Merchant Capital. They are an alternative lender, giving us some insight into what the lending space is looking like at the moment from their vantage point, particularly hinging the conversation around being a generalist and the fact that a lot of specialists in a number of different sectors and industries have been forced to diversify themselves and become more generalist in how they actually approach their different markets and their different product offerings during this time and going forward. That might be a way for businesses to actually ensure their own survival. He was also just giving us some insight into what the possible funding gap actually looks like in the SME sector. And he's saying that going forward, we're likely to see a situation where you have both traditional lenders and alternative lenders working together, sort of with a symbiotic relationship, to actually drive small businesses forward and actually help to plug some of those funding gaps that do exist in the economy. So that's been it. Thank you so much to Dor for just taking his time to join us on this platform.
This is Mudiwa's Take.
A very interesting discussion with Merchant Capital's Dorf Durnham. And one of the things that is quite central is this issue around the rise of the generalist, because we did recently have Lulaland, and some of the issues around working capital and the plight of small businesses in terms of getting paid and issues like that, there are some common themes. But when it comes to this rise of the generalist, it certainly does give us, you know, some alternatives in the economy just around how businesses actually survive and move forward. Because being a generalist means just being able to offer more than just whatever the specialized product is. And as some of the examples that were given during the discussion, such as alcohol manufacturers switching over their production to sanitizers, for example, it certainly does bode well if a person does have that diversified portfolio where they can sort of hedge their bets and hedge their risk, to say if this one product or line of service does not work out or is affected or impacted by a pandemic like what COVID-19 has done, then there is a fallback position where you have an alternative revenue stream or alternative product lines that you can then use to maybe spread the risk for your business. That's the first thing. But the second thing is that something like COVID-19 has forced businesses to actually look at their offering and decide what it actually means going forward to hedge your bets. A lot of companies have maybe insurance policies in place to hedge risk against the rand falling. People have products in place, derivatives, all of these things. But just as a simple business, what are you doing for yourself to make sure that if you can't rely on your one line of business, what else can you do? And COVID-19 has really forced people to think about things from that end. But at the same time, it's not always like a fundamental shift. It's also just how can you use what you have in a different way to generate revenue for yourself. And the example of the restaurant now shifting over to a grocery type of setup is a good example of that, because the premises is the same. You're still giving out food. You're still providing, you know, that atmosphere that people usually come to a restaurant for. But now, because you can't sell in the traditional way, you're now offering essential goods and services like groceries, and you've been able to continue to trade at a time when you'd otherwise have been shutting down your doors for 3 months. So diversification, maybe there is a case to be made that 2020 is the year of diversifying. So remember that you can find our latest podcast on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab. And then on Twitter, we are #BDSpotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. Thank you to our amazing team. Our producer is Paige Muller, together with Didi Mashamaite. I've been Mliwa Gabaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail, and this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So for myself and the rest of the team, it is good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.